Sharon Salzberg tells the story of when she was 18 and had the idea to go to India to study Buddhism. Her childhood had been a swirl of grief, with both of her parents dying tragically before she was 11. So when she discovered Buddhism, she was hopeful at the promise of a path beyond suffering. It was just a few days before her trip, however, and she hadn't really figured out a plan for what she would do in India to study Buddhism. So she was getting a little anxious, and so she looked up in the local newspaper and found that there was going to be a talk by a well-respected Buddhist teacher in a nearby town. So she decided just to go and see if maybe he could offer some advice. So at the end of his talk, he invited questions from the audience. And so she wrote her question out and submitted it for his consideration. And wonderfully, he selected it first from the pile. "In a few days, I am leaving for India to study Buddhism. Do you have any recommendations as to where I should go?" After some silence, eventually the teacher responded, "In this matter, you had perhaps best follow the pretense of accident." That, she says, was it. No names, no addresses, no maps or directions, just follow the pretense of accident. I've been wrestling for some time with the ideas of accident and fate, chance and destiny, what theologians call providence. Our theology of providence is the ideas we have for God's participation in the unfolding of life. When people say, "It's meant to be," they are making an assertion of providence, imagining that somehow there's a right teleos, or end, that we are moving towards, whether individually or as an interdependent whole. The word providence itself is rooted in the promise of being provided for, that God or life or nature or whatever construct you might give credit to will care for the whole of creation. That life will go precisely as it is somehow meant to go, or perhaps most importantly, that there is a right path for life, a right path for each individual life and for life as a whole, and that somehow we could follow and discern and then follow this designated path. I've been wrestling with these ideas because, truthfully, my instinct, my impulse, is to say they are ridiculous. My instinct is that life is simply a series of events that sometimes unfolds in ways we find beautiful and sometimes tragic. But none of this is attributable to some kind of concept of destiny. We see patterns where there are no patterns, see what we want to see. Rather than the pretense being accident, I'd say the pretense is plan. There's no plan. There's no right path, no provision by some transcendent force, however conceived. It's all just chance, randomness, luck, coincidence. But I've been wrestling because life keeps giving me evidence to the contrary. Just as one example, last June, I was at the airport leaving General Assembly in Louisville, headed home after a week away. And the group of us from Foothills had attended many workshops, shared in conversation over many meals, celebrated together in many wonderful worship services. One of those workshops was titled something like, "So your minister is going to retire." And since about half of us at GA were indeed privy to Mark's then mostly secret plans, and the other half knew it was probably sometime in the near future, we were all of us first in line to attend that workshop. There were a bunch of panelists, but one stood out to us. He identified himself as an interim who often follows retired ministers. And we all appreciated his insights into the complicated feelings present in a congregation through such a transition. After that workshop, our group whispered to each other, "Who is that? Maybe he will be our interim. Let's find out about him." It was such early speculation with such a huge, long process to go that none of us exactly took it all that seriously. But then, I was at the airport on my way home, and I sat down in the food court, and who just happened to sit down next to me but that same guy from the workshop? So I introduced myself. I told him about Foothills, my recent arrival, and our upcoming transition. He told me about the congregation he was serving in Virginia, and about his grandchildren in New Mexico and his home base on the West Coast. After a bit, it was time to go to the plane. We were to take the same one, it turned out. We said goodbye and said maybe our paths will cross again someday. Fast forward nearly a year later to this last May and our own interim search process. And in my inbox, an email. It was from the minister on that panel, the same who I had met at the airport. He began, "I remember our conversation in the food court at the airport. And I'd hoped then we would meet again." And then he went on to say how impressed he was with the Foothills application. Reading his email, I just had this overwhelming sense of joy and gratitude. Like, chills. A couple days later on the phone, he told me, "Now I don't know if it's going too far to say this, but I feel like I may have a calling to be there at Foothills." I said, "No, it's a random series of events." So a few weeks later, the interim search team calls me to say that after considering 9 different wonderful applicants, that same minister from the workshop, from the airport, and from the email, David Keyes, would be our interim. I mean, the whole thing all unfolded as if according to some mysterious and beautiful plan. When these kinds of things happen, when all kinds of variables that could have gone a different way seem to work together with a mysterious unity, it's hard not to feel like there's some kind of plan. And we're just here to receive life's incredible gifts, to stand in wonder and gratitude. And yet, how we choose to interpret these events does have some pretty serious consequences. Because if these things are all somehow unfolding according to some kind of plan, then are all things a part of that plan? Which is to say, if God is the provider when things are going well, is God also the withholder when children are starving, when families are homeless, when illness strikes, when relationships are irrevocably broken? And then are these too some kind of larger divine order? One more story from my own life. Now, many of you are aware that my children are adopted through foster care. But maybe not as many realize what that phrase actually means. My kid's birth mom did not choose to place her children for adoption. She wanted to parent. So much she wanted to parent. But ultimately, she wasn't able to. Due to a variety of reasons. She had been raised in foster care herself, 11 different homes from the age of 6 to 18 when she aged out. She never learned the tools and never experienced what it meant to be held in love. And from this terrible generational tragedy arrived my life's 2 greatest blessings. First, Gracie in 2005 when she was 2 days old. And then again, when we got another call out of the blue that Gracie had a biological brother 3 days old, would we come pick him up? So Joseph came home when he was 5 days old. Tiny, 4 pounds, beautiful. Sometimes I wonder to myself that his birth mom's worst day was my best. Twice. So was this somehow part of a plan? Does somehow the life we can give them now redeem the tragedy that was their birth family's past? No. I don't know. Maybe. I don't know. I have a friend in seminary. I had a friend in seminary whose grandparents were survivors of the Holocaust. When these kinds of questions were raised, she would say that her entire test of whether or not a theological claim was true or valid came down to whether or not it could stand up in the presence of burning children. And from that perspective, calling anything meant to be feels absurd and cruel. And yet somehow this also calls to mind a story from physicist Leonard Mlodinow, whose parents were also Holocaust survivors. One day in the camp, Mlodinow's father stole a chunk of bread from the bakery. And when it was discovered, the guards lined up all who had access and could have stolen it and said, "If the person who did this doesn't come forward, we will just start shooting everyone." And so his father stepped forward and confessed. He made the choice to step forward. And then the guard, rather than doing what you would expect, dismissed everyone and ended up hiring Mlodinow's father to work in the bakery, which in one way or another protected his father and allowed him to survive the concentration camp. His father's first wife and children were not so lucky. And it also meant that his father then would go on to meet his mother, and then he would be born. And his children were born. He says he spent a lot of time struggling with what it means for his life to be the result of such randomness in the midst of such an incredible tragedy. The Taoist tradition tells the story of a farmer who had only one horse. And then one day, that horse ran away. The neighbors came to console him over his terrible loss. The farmer said, "We'll see." A month later, the horse came back, this time bringing with him 2 beautiful wild horses. The neighbors were so excited at the farmer's good fortune. "Such lovely, strong horses," the farmer said. "We'll see." The farmer's son shortly thereafter was riding one of those wild horses and was thrown off and broke his leg. Oh, the neighbors were very distressed. "Such bad luck." And the farmer said, "We'll see." Shortly thereafter, a war came, and every able-bodied young man was sent into battle, except the farmer's son, because he had a broken leg. And so he had to stay behind. The neighbors congratulated the farmer, and once again he said, "We'll see." In the moment, each of these things that happened to the farmer were good and bad, good and bad. But in the fullness of time, they were the opposite. Which doesn't mean that any of us would have wished that his horse would run off. but only that we cannot predict the ways that various causes and effects will work out. We can't know how one day's tragedy will be another day's blessing. As our reading says, as long as you are alive, the story of your life is still being told, and the meaning is still open. And as long as there is life in the world, the story of the world is still being told. And so if you today are in one of those moments that feels impossible and final in the worst possible ways, with this in mind, I offer the good news that it's not final. There is more story. So much more story to come. Which is to say that perhaps in the fullness of time, imagining that there is some greater goodness that we are destined for. As I told you last week, those words from Theodore Parker picked up by King and Obama, imagining that there is some greater moral arc that bends towards justice, that perhaps in the fullness of time, such an idea need not be dangerous naivete. Perhaps in the fullness of time, it is true, as theologian Julian Hart puts it, the moral flow of the world may suffer momentary checks, but it is irresistible. Actually, Obama did not simply repeat Theodore Parker's phrase. He used the construct, but then he went on to say, but here's the thing, it does not bend on its own. It bends because each of us, in our own ways, put our hand on the arc and we bent it in the direction of justice. Which brings me back to physicist Leonard Mlodinow. So Mlodinow, you may know, he studies randomness and chance alongside the possibilities of choice and destiny, and uses the concept of Brownian motion to help unpack how all these things work. Anyone know it? Brownian motion? Oh, okay, so I barely do. It's very new to me, so bear with me. Here's the way I understand it, and after service, you all can correct me. But here's generally how I understand it. Particles appear to move randomly for no apparent reason. And originally, people concluded that the movement was life force or energy or God. But eventually, Einstein realized that this particle movement is happening because molecules are pushing the particles this way and that. So it isn't exactly random. There's a reason. And this, Mlodinow says, parallels our lives. Because it might feel, when you look at your life, like so many things are random. But in the midst of what appears random, we are given choices about how we'll react. And it is our reaction that determines what life presents next. We are the molecules pushing the universe this way and that. Now, old and orthodox ideas of God that imagined God as entirely other and entirely far, far away ensured that traditional concepts of providence forced a false choice. God versus human, supernatural versus natural. But we have many other constructs of God today, and such profoundly better understandings of the universe, limited though they each still remain, that we need not imagine God as distant or distinct from the natural world in order to embrace a theology of providence. Process theology, just as one example, imagines a God that fully participates in life, co-creates with life, and that, in fact, God is the luring of life into greater goodness, a greater love. God is the pull of love. Or, as feminist theologians have urged, God isn't love the noun, but love the verb, luring us all to what the Jewish tradition might call God's shalom, which is often translated as peace, but is better understood as harmony. Great interdependent harmony. Shalom. In this concept of providence, we are all partners. Not we, but big we, all of life, across time and space, all of us, little molecules pushing up against one another, and we lure each other, pull one another along to a greater sense of justice and love. And sometimes, amazingly, we all line up. Sometimes, as poet Seamus Heaney put it, hope and history rhyme. But nothing's a given. Nothing, as the reading says, is settled. And so everything matters. Everything matters. So let us choose well and follow the plan.